Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, the U.S. Supreme Court decides that Wisconsin's record number of absentee ballots must be turned in by 8 p.m. Tuesday, Election Day. Two final polls say Joe Biden still leads President Trump, but both are making final appeals to Wisconsin voters in the state. The state Supreme Court will rule on a challenge to the face mask mandate Governor Tony Evers ordered to fight COVID-19 surge. Two state Senate races have each already cost more than $2 million. And a recall Evers move fails. Rewind, your week in review for October 30.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is the week before the election, so plenty of news. But let's start with the U.S. Supreme Court ruling, which just a few days before Tuesday's election said all absentee ballots must be counted by 8 p.m. on Tuesday, election night. A little bit of background. This had been back and forth because District Court Judge William Conley had allowed the absentee ballots to be counted through 8 p.m. on November 9th. But the Supreme Court ruling forces, as I said, the absentee ballots, which, JR, let me get the total right. We have, as of this morning, 1.73 million ballots returned, 542,000 of those in person. So we're looking at, when you look at 1.73 million, about 58% of all ballots cast for president in 2016. Just a couple more points before I ask JR for his update on that. So the Republicans had pushed for the 8 p.m. November 3 deadline. And just a quote from Chief Justice Roberts, different bodies of law and different precedents govern these two situations and require that we allow the 8 p.m. Friday deadline in Pennsylvania, but not in Wisconsin. So, JR, Pennsylvania has until 8 p.m. Friday, and North Carolina, you and I know, can count absentee ballots up to 9 days after November 3. But the Supreme Court said Wisconsin absentee ballots must be in and due 8 p.m. on November 3. Connect these dots, as our governor says for me.
One of the differences is that you had a federal judge in Wisconsin who ordered the change, whereas in the other states, you had state officials, state courts, state officials directing those changes. That's one, generally speaking, that's one change, difference between those cases. Other thing is, this is happening very close to the election. It's called the Purcell Principle. The U.S. Supreme Court has a standard they do not like to have changes in state election laws, administration laws. The administration of state election laws be changed close to an election. It just causes confusion. So there's that piece to it. And in reading the concurring opinions, the argument was that it is easy to vote absentee in Wisconsin. There's been a lot of time to prepare for this. This is not, you know, an emergency situation. And so you've had time to prepare. You can do the normal procedure and you'll be fine, essentially.
Well, it's just pretty interesting because when you look at the
542,000 in-person ballots cast, 86,000 of them in Milwaukee, that's 15%, almost 16% of the in-person, 66,000 in Waukesha, that's 12% of in-person ballots cast, 51,000 cast in Dane, so a total of 37% of the 542,000 in-person have just been cast in those three counties. Any PS before we move on?
Just remember, in Wisconsin, you'll see all these people trying to tell you, like, what this means. Yes. And the hard thing is, in Wisconsin, we don't have partisan registration. So I can't tell you how those guys are Democrats versus Republicans. Now, I've seen modeling that suggests that this is good for Democrats. But that's modeling. It's not actual numbers about things. So when you see on social media somebody say, hey, look, this is actually great for so-and-so, it runs counter to the narrative, be cautious to believe that. We don't know. For example, Waukesha County has had a great return rate of its absentee ballots.
Yes.
Waukesha County also happens to be one of the biggest producers of Democratic votes in the state, not because it's a Democratic county, but because it is a large county with a lot of voters in it. So, you know, I'm not going to lie. I've seen so many numbers, read so many polls, looked so many finance reports. My eyes want to bleed at this point, this election.
Got it. Okay.
Record turnout, 3.1 million people. The presidential election. Now, that as a percentage is not a record, but I think we could see more than 3.1 million votes cast come Election Day when it's all said and done.
How many absentee ballots? Nobody knows when we'll finally know who won Wisconsin. Okay, let's move on. Two final polls today, this week, continue to show Vice President Biden ahead. The UW-Madison Elections Research Center had the Vice President had 53-44, margin of error 4%. The Marquette University Law School poll, Mr. Biden 48, Mr. Trump 43, Joe Jorgensen, Libertarian candidate, 2. And then I was also intrigued by the independent voters in the Charles Franklin survey. Independent voters, Biden 36, Trump 28, Joe Jorgensen, Libertarian 12, 24% don't know, won't say. JR, how big a news are these two polls?
A couple of things. One, the Marquette poll has been the gold standard of polling in Wisconsin for a long time. That poll, what's been remarkable about it is the durability of the Biden lead. It has been 4 to 6 points since May. It has not moved. Think what we've been through as a country since May, what news you've seen, what dramatic stories have broken since May, and it hasn't moved anything. So my questions are this. One, what could possibly move this race between now and Tuesday to dramatically swing it either way to a Biden big win or a Trump narrow victory? Number two, what happens to those undecided voters? If you look at the Marquette poll, we are kind of at a parallel to where we were 4 years ago with Marquette, that about 7% say they either aren't sure, didn't like either of them, or wouldn't say who they're going to vote for. What we knew from 4 years ago is there was some late breaking news after that poll came out of the field with the FBI reopening the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails and quickly closing it. That helped the swing of voters toward Donald Trump. So while Marquette was off, quote unquote, and where it had things, it actually was on. It had Clinton's number nailed. They just missed that late push toward Trump. In this poll, frankly, an exercise where he took the undecideds and said, okay, if they're favorable to Trump, but not to Biden, he put him in the Trump camp. Favorable to Biden, but not to Trump, put him in the Biden camp. Favorable to both of them or unfavorable to both of them, he left them out. That moved the poll to 50-45. There is not seemingly a big swing of people right now out there. Now, tell things keep in mind, it's a poll, right? Polls can sometimes miss things. There's a margin for error. What I've been told by numerous people this week and looking at the presidential race in Wisconsin is that Biden has an advantage. He is in good position. One thing to remember is that Trump's job approval rating in the Marquette polls, I believe 47%. That's a good indicator of where a ceiling for a candidate is, an incumbent is often. The question for Trump is, can he hit that, but also then find new voters? People didn't turn out 4 years ago who aren't high propensity voters, people who maybe never voted before, especially blue collar white males who are a big part of his base, and turn them out in record numbers. Because if you look at Dane County, it's going to produce once again for Joe Biden, for a Democrat. Look at Milwaukee County, looks more engaged than 4 years ago. If you're Trump, you have to offset that somewhere. And so his path to victory seems to be finding those low propensity or maybe not ever voted before voters in rural Wisconsin and getting them to polls to offset the advantage that Biden seems to have. And again, I stress seems to have, because this is a poll. As Franklin says, polls don't vote.
Right. And let's come back to that seems to have. Okay.
Two different subject. The Governor Tony Evers administration has tried to fight the COVID surge in two ways, ordering that masks be worn in enclosed areas and the 25% occupancy limit. First, let's talk about the mask up order. What happened this week? The Supreme Court agreed to accept the challenge to the mask up order. You had a 4-3 decision. They've ordered arguments, oral arguments for November 16th. The court's 4-3 conservative majority agreed to directly take the challenge to the order by Governor Evers requiring face masks in enclosed areas. The challenge had been filed by business executive Jerry Fabik. The court specifically asked, when you file briefs, deal with this issue. Did the governor's mask up order, is it an unconstitutional delegation of legislative power to the executive branch? And the order put on hold the Polk County case in which a judge had upheld the face mask order. And before I give JR a chance, I just want to note the dissent filed by three justices led by Justice Rebecca Dallet. Now, the issue is, Supreme Court, would you take we're filing a petition for what's called an original action. We want you to set aside all lower court proceedings and take this case directly. And here's what Justice Dalit said in dissent. Our original action jurisdiction is not meant to allow a single disgruntled taxpayer, that's a reference to Mr. Fabik, to jump the line to achieve a desired outcome. The lower court should be permitted to carry on without unnecessary and premature interruptions. Big deal, JR, that the court's going to directly listen to arguments and then eventually rule on the mask up order?
Yeah, I mean, the court has been asked more frequently in recent years to take these cases directly. On the one hand, you can argue that it expedites the process to get a decision. Normally, it goes circuit court, appeals court, Supreme Court, and those lower two bodies develop the record. They're kind of, you know, have a robust proceedings before them that the court then gets final say on. Now we're skipping those two lower levels, and the Supreme Court become the record developing court, which is unusual. It's also noteworthy, and we're not really getting this today, but there was a request from two counties this week for guidance on how to handle about 11,500 ballots that have a flaw in how they were printed, how to fix them. They were asking original action in that case. The court said no, because they said basically it didn't explain why, but the hint was they can't do an advisory opinion. So it's odd sometimes to look at what they're deciding, like what cases they take and what cases they don't. A common thread has been that they've been challenges filed by conservatives. It's a conservative court. I don't know if that's the reason why, but you're seeing more and more often conservative groups, especially Wisconsin's for Law and Liberty, going directly to the Supreme Court to take cases that they want to be decided quickly. Now, you could argue with the mask mandate, with the limits on public gatherings, these are public health emergencies. They need to be are decided quickly. But it's not the court we're used to seeing from when we both first started covering this stuff years ago.
Right. And I just want to elaborate, JR. That petition
asking the Supreme Court for guidance was filed by the clerks of Outagamie and Calumet counties. And their petition said, look, we're talking here at 11,000 votes or 13,000 votes that cannot be read, absentee ballots that cannot be read by voting machines. Tell us to give us an extension to count them, or we can make a simple mark on the timing piece of paper, the timing part of that ballot, and have that machine read it, give us guidance. And the clerk said, I just want to read from their petition, the issue is one of great urgency given the impending presidential election and projected slim margin in votes. Remember, President Trump won Wisconsin by less than 23,000 votes in 2016. Okay, now let's turn to the other way that the Evers administration has tried to curb the COVID-19 surge. And that is with the 25% occupancy limit on rooms and businesses. And what happened this week? Third District Court of Appeals, Northwestern Wisconsin, 2-1 split, overturning the lower court judge and blocking the Evers administration occupancy limit in rooms and businesses. Now, just I think yesterday, JR, as WisPolitics reported, the Evers administration has asked the Supreme Court to directly decide that case. So, but let's say, let's establish Milwaukee and Madison have their own occupancy code. So we're talking here about the rest of the state outside. Now, the backdrop, we saw two tragic records on Tuesday. On Tuesday, Wisconsin reported 5,262 positive tests and 64 deaths. Today's total, just reported by DHS, 5,096 positive cases and I think an additional 24 deaths. So we talk to me about the procedure now in how the Evers administration wants to eventually implement the 25% occupancy, please.
Yeah, so remember, this is somewhat different than what we're talking about with original actions. And this one, a Polk County case has already had a circuit court judge say the limits are okay, that the governor's not exceeding his authority in doing that. That has been appealed to the Third District Court of Appeals in Wausau. That court, a week ago, stayed the decision, prevented the limits from being enforced while it handles the appeal. This is requesting to basically skip one step, not two, right? Having the Supreme Court take the appeal directly, not the case directly. That said, the Evers administration wants to have limits on indoor public gatherings of 25% of a room's occupancy. It was supposed to be a 28-day order. The reason behind it was, their argument was, that the cycle for COVID, coronavirus, is 14 days. They want to get through two cycles to try and limit how much we're around each other, to get through that and try and tamp down these numbers, because they are raging right now in Wisconsin and are not showing signs of letting up. That was a rationale behind it. But we have not had enforcement of this order. It's been spotty at best since governor issued it. So we're also not seeing a drop in numbers right now, right? So the governor made a plea this week, please. He essentially said, please do a self-imposed stay-at-home order. Please stay home. Please don't travel. Please limit your contact with other people. Limit your circle of who you're in contact with, because we need to get this virus under control in Wisconsin.
Right. And this is the time when I want to
play a video. DHS Secretary Designee Andrea Palm talks about the confusion on again, off again of the 25% occupancy. But at the end of this video clip, the chief medical officer, Dr. Ryan Westergaard, talks about a nightmare scenario. So this is an important clip, please.
The order was enjoined, and then it was on, and then it was enjoined again. And so the ability of it to really take hold and do the kind of public health transmission, break in transmission that we're looking for out of a capacity limits order really has not been allowed to work. And so with all of these interruptions and the confusion that the injunctions have caused about is it on, is it off, should I do it, should I not do it, has really, I think, minimized the impact that the order unfortunately will have on the public health. But I think the broader point remains that people should stay home as much as possible, order or no order, enforceable or not enforceable. It is the safest and best thing we can do to stop the spread of this disease.
I think Wisconsinites are extraordinarily empathetic. My concern is that when leaders don't act in an empathetic way, whether that's at the federal level or the state level, people are going to follow that cue. If leaders are not portraying an empathetic value, then people that might be empathetic at their core, but they respect the leader and that leader's opinion, that's, in my opinion, where the trouble begins.
The trajectory is 100,000 cases in 36 days, in an environment where we still think the large majority of people have not been exposed to the virus, gives us very, it's a nightmare scenario, frankly, that this could get quite a bit worse in the next several weeks or months before it gets better. And so the fact that it's already highest levels widespread, and we think most people haven't been exposed yet, is really a concerning scenario.
JR, you at Wispolitics, keeps really close tabs on campaign spending, but I know you were swamped this week. So I asked the Wisconsin Democracy campaign to calculate from the spending by candidates, from legislative campaign committees, and from third-party and independent special interests, total spending through October 19th. And six of our legislative races have now spent more than $1 million. I just want to highlight four of them, then I'll give you a chance to comment on each of the four. So let's look through October 29th, 2 weeks before the election. A lot of money is going to be spent in these final 2 weeks. First, the Senate District 32, Dan Kopanky versus Brad Pfaff, $2.45 million. Mr. Pfaff and Democratic groups, $1.34 million of that. Second most expensive race through October 19th, and that's an important date, was the Senate District 30, Jonathan Hansen, Democrat, versus Eric Wimberger, $2.35 million. And of that, candidate Hansen, the Democrat, $1.13 million. Number four, most costliest districts through October 19th, and I keep coming back to that, Senate District 10, $1.66 million. And of that, independent spending by third-party groups, $671,000. Finally, of the top four, $1.52 million spent through October 19th in Senate District 8, incumbent Senator Alberta Darling, the Republican, versus Neil Plotkin. Okay, JR, just of those four Senate races, what's your sense? Which of them might be the tightest? Because we're not pundits. We're not going to make any calls here.
Everything I've been heard talking to people is that the Green Bay area seat is probably a true toss-up. People on both sides of the aisle believe that Brad Papp has an edge in the 32nd Senate District over Dan Kopanky. You can see that in the spending because the Republican groups had kind of pulled out of that race the final weeks. It was a late buy. They came in there for helping Kopanky, but it looks like Brad's in a favorable position. Up in the 10th Senate District, Rob Stassel, Republican, has an edge. It's probably a significant one over Patty Schotten, the Democrat. It's a plus 17 Trump district. The spending has been heavily tilted toward Rob Stassel. That's usually a sign. Then you kind of get into Alberta Darling's seat against Neil Plotkin. I've heard various levels of concern from Republicans about polling they've seen that suggests a tighter race than they'd expected a month and a half ago. That is an example of the Trump problem in suburban Wisconsin that can make keep that race tight. And then up in Pat Teston's seat against Paul Piotrowski, that district is more Trump than Republican, I've been told. So the president's not having an issue there. That probably helps Pat Teston, though. There's been a lot of spending up there. You got to keep an eye on it. But I've never seen such a small map with so much spending in it. Now, we went through the recall elections, you know, a decade ago and saw all kinds of spending, but there were a lot of seats out there. This is a five-seat map. There's almost nothing going on anywhere else, and they're all north of $1 million. I believe when it's all said and done that at least one will cross a $3 million mark, which is crazy. I remember congressional races that were contested and not reaching $3 million. Talking about a state Senate seat, this is unprecedented spending. It's driven by the State Democratic Party of Wisconsin's success in raising money. It's allowed it to funnel it out to its candidates and level the playing field or tilt it in their favor in the spending race.
Okay, but it's not a record.
Looked it up. The record for all spending in a legislative seat, $4.5 million. And that was in 2018, won by Senator Howard Markline of Spring Green. So we're not talking a record here. But I just want to finish up with this topic. Two other races, total spending through October 19th. Assembly District 14, incumbent Democrat Robin Vining versus Republican Bonnie Lee, $1.38 million. Of that, Democrats have spent $858,000. And finally, Senate District 24, incumbent Republican Senator Pat Teston versus Paul Piotrowski, total spending $1.29 million. So, yes, some huge numbers, but the record, $4.5 million in the Howard Markline race. Okay, let's move on to JR. You reported, and you and the Associated Press reporters, hackers stole $2.3 million from the Republican Party. Fill in the, give me the context of that.
So what Andrew Hitt, the state party chair, told us is that they had been kind of told to be on the watch for any kind of phishing attacks. They had taken some precautions, but apparently one email got through that then opened the door to some people who he said had intimate knowledge of how the state party works to manipulate some data and some invoices, redirect money to them and steal it. It's been turned over to the FBI for investigation. Now, Hitt said they haven't had to cut anything yet when I talked to him yesterday, but there are always last-minute decisions that you make as a party about where to go and what to do, and it's going to hamper them unless they can raise the money to offset this or get transferred to them from the national party. So it's not a great thing to have happen. Also, worthy of noting, the Democratic Party told me that they had had 800 attempts at phishing attacks in the past year, I believe. None had been successful, but they also were told us to be on guard and watch for this kind of stuff. And honestly, like Hitt said, the person who did it or persons who did it struck at a time when a state party is spending a whole lot of money in a battleground state and just kind of right time, right place, got through with one email and opened the door to taking this money.
Okay. And this was money that was
focused on the president's reelection bid, correct?
Okay.
All right, let's move on. There had been a petition drive to recall Governor Tony Evers and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, and that was the organizers of that drive had until Tuesday to file 668,327 signatures based on the 2018 vote for governor. But they announced on Monday that they were not going to meet that deadline, not going to file those number of signatures. The governor and lieutenant governor had been targeted by those organizing a potential recall for their handling of the pandemic and their response to the policing reform protests and the civil unrest and the violence in Kenosha. The governor last week told reporters the potential of a recall was, quote, not a high priority. The backdrop, of course, in 2012, Republican Governor Scott Walker survived a recall more than a year after he signed Act 10. He beat Democrat Tom Barrett. Just if you're a geek, Wisconsin residents added the recall provision of the state constitution in 1926. The recall organizer said, "It is with a heavy heart we announce it after proofing, and what came in over the weekend we have fallen short. We do not have enough signatures to turn in." And JR, what I find interesting, we don't know how many signatures they had, and those signatures are going to be destroyed, so no one can use it for or against anybody in the future. What's your take on the failed recall effort? Excuse me.
Well, we talked about it last week. People were kind of skeptical they could get that mark at 678,000 and change, I think it is, because if you recall in 2011 when the recall drive against Walker began, there were armies of people with clipboards seemingly everywhere in Wisconsin, out in the public gathering signatures. Now, you have a pandemic that's been going on that limits contact. You do have advances in social media that can kind of open some doors that way. But it just seemed like in talking to people, they were skeptical they could get that number because they weren't backed by the state party. They weren't backed by a grassroots organization that has a statewide network. So it was like, if they got it, more power to them, but skeptical they would do it. And this kind of proved the difficulty in collecting them. And, you know, people are skeptical when she said that, you know, we're destroying what we know is on the wrong hands. It's like, well, yeah, but also because you fell short, you don't admit how far short you were, because it's a huge hurdle to cross without an army of people behind you to try and get the signatures.
Right. Okay. We're running short on time. Next segment, Battleground, Wisconsin. We had the president here, the vice president, and the second lady here. We have both Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump in the state, and Mr. Trump will be returning again to Racine before the election. But let's listen to voices from the campaign trail, please.
Hello, Wisconsin. It's great to be with you. This election is a choice between a Trump super recovery or a Biden depression. That's what you're going to have with a raise of taxes. The biggest tax increase in our history. It's ridiculous. It's a choice between a Trump boom or a Biden lockdown. Let's lock it all down. And by the way, speaking of lockdowns, let's get your governor to open it up. Let's get him to open it up. We have made America strong again. We have made America proud again. We have made America safe again. And we will make America great again. Thank you, Wisconsin. Thank you very much. Get out and vote.
Just like 2016, we're going to show America that Wisconsin is Trump country. I mean, here in Wisconsin, you believe we could be strong again. You believe we could be prosperous again. You said yes to President Donald Trump in 2016. And after last night and today, I just know Wisconsin's going to say yes to four more years of President Donald Trump in 2020.
This is going to be a close race, especially in Wisconsin. It is going to come down to the wire. It's going to be every vote, every single vote. It's going to be every dollar, every phone call, every knock on the door could make the difference. It's going to mean each one of you in this last stretch talking to your neighbors and friends, standing in line to vote. You know, you said yes to Donald Trump in 2016, Wisconsin. And so we want you to say yes to Donald Trump again in 2020. So we need four more years of President Trump and Vice President Pence, and we will make America great again, again.
Okay, the good news is we've got so much news this week. The bad news is you don't have much time for stocks. Go.
Rising Rebecca Clayfish, former lieutenant governor, formed a PAC to help legislative candidates. She's doled out more than $114,000, I believe, to 100 candidates, more than 100 candidates. Those are chips, we call them in politics, right, Steve? Those guys will remember that next year when she announces running for governor. Also, real quickly, the recall effort falling apart is actually good for Clayfish because she wants to run in 2022. If you had a recall election, but put a tough spot, do you run in a recall election that you've already said you're opposed to them because you were a Sutter one, you know, 10 years ago? But if you do that, you could possibly lose. If you don't run, then you probably irritate some people in the base who want to go after Eber. So it takes a messy thing off of her plate.
Okay, mixed.
Robin Voss. So look, the effort against Robin Voss flows from the thinking among Democrats that he is vulnerable. If you add up a base unhappy that hasn't done anything about the mask mandate, swing voters unhappy about he sued the governor about, you know, the stay-at-home order and Foxconn not coming to fruition, his numbers are soft. That's backed up by the fact he had his wife do a straight-to-camera ad defending him. That's usually done when you have to rehabilitate your numbers, right? When you're not in the ad, but your spouse is. But beyond that, there are a couple reasons to do this. One, they have the money, so they can. Two, by spending money against Robin, you force him to defend his seat. It pulls money from other places it could have gone to. Three, there are people in the Democratic base who dislike Robin Voss so much, they will give you money to go after him. So you can raise money by spending money. And finally, you can rattle his cage. If you look at how Robin's reaction to this, he does seem a little bit put off by this, not sure kind of his footing. And Democrats, quite frankly, are enjoying watching that because, you know, he's tormented them for so many years. Now he's on the defensive. It's kind of something they're enjoying a little bit.
Falling.
UAB employees got to take another furlough. It's just a sign of the financial straits the university is in right now. What's going on the state budget?
Okay. And looking ahead, if you're
going to vote in person on Tuesday and you want some more information on candidates, WisconsinEye, WisSci.org. We have in-depth interviews with more than 225 candidates. If you're holding an absentee ballot, don't put it in the mail. The governor said that. Megan Wolf says that. Get it to your local clerk. So pre-election, exciting. Boy, that's kind of more fun than we're allowed to have, JR. Do you agree?
Yeah, it's fun, all right.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm JR Ross.
That's Rewind for October 30.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.